For all intents and purposes, this is Connections from WXXI, and I'm Evan Dawson. I hope I haven't offended you with that botch of language. You might be in high dungeon over that as we pound our fists and talk about writing and why we mangle language. This hour, we have a wonderful panel of writers far better than me, and they're going to talk to us about how we all become better writers, why language matters, why writing matters, what their process is of improving, how they sort of evaluate their own work, and what we all can learn from that. It's just going to be a great fun hour on writing. I hope that you enjoy that kind of subject. I certainly do. And our panel starts with Eric Grody, who writes about theater and film regularly for the New York Times and teaches in the Gold Ring Arts Journalism Program at Syracuse University. Eric, a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. Pleasure's mine.
Andrea Lewandowski is here. She's a freelance writer for 585 Magazine and DeeperStory.com. She writes a blog, and she's the author of a soon-to-be-published memoir as well. I know it's going to feel more official when it is published, but you're on your way.
I'm on my way.
Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Kevin Carr is studying creative writing at the University of Rochester, writes at thenumberkevin.com, writes for various publications, 585 included, has covered the fringe more extensively than just about any living person, at least here in Rochester. Is that all fair to say?
That's fair.
And I've asked you all to come prepared with your favorite egg corn. So before we even dive into how to become a better writer, let me start with Eric Grody. You have an egg corn for us?
I do, and I actually had a guy I used to work with at a magazine who was a font or a fount of acorns. That might be one right there.
there he is.
He had a lot of them. And my favorite one was he would often refer to something that was going on. His way of saying that something that was to be expected, he was, well, that's just part of the course. He would always refer to things as being part of the course.
Not par for the course?
Correct.
That's just part of the course. But the funny thing about that is the best acorns are mangled words or phrases that still retain some level of meaning, right?
Well, we were looking this up, and it sounds like they're actually the only true eggcorns, as opposed to malapropisms,
right,
which are things you say that you just misspeak. But if you misspeak and it makes perfect sense, like we were saying, butt naked as opposed to buck naked, there's a reason why it lodges in your brain that it's not implausible.
It's not implausible. I grew up thinking that the people who lived in the house next to our property lived in the next store, as in NECKSTORE. And then for some reason in my brain, it made sense that it would be the next door because you have to arch your neck around to see who's next door. And they had the store just in case you needed a new neck. Now, when you're an 8-year-old, this makes total sense. But as an adult, next door, it seems really ridiculous. But that was my own egg corn. Andrea Lewandowski?
Oh, gosh. I don't actually say this, but we talked about this last night. We were brainstorming some, and espresso came up. And I think that drives people nuts.
But I think that's actually an acorn because it may get you moving on a faster plane, right? Yeah. Espresso cranks you up to sort of an express mode. Is that fair?
I'd go with that, sure.
So that's sort of a malaprop that became an acorn.
Sure, yeah.
That's good. Kevin?
Well, for the longest time, especially when I was a kid, I watched a lot of Law and Order, and there would always be this discussion of a statute of limitations, and for the longest time I thought there was a statute of limitations somewhere that people would go and look at to go, can we still sue for this? Okay, let's look at this statute. Oh no, okay, we can't. So then I read it somewhere that it was statute, and at first I thought it was misspelled, which I thought was odd. Turns out it's actually statute of limitations.
And just in case you're still having a hard time grasping the concept of an eggcorn, let's listen to a great American philosopher named Joey Tribbiani, who had a great eggcorn in his day.
The big question is, does he like you? Right? Because if he doesn't like you, this is all a moot point.
A moot point?
Yeah. It's like a cow's opinion. It just doesn't matter. It's moo.
That's Joey Tribbiani from Friends, Matt LeBlanc, the actor, sharing what his thoughts were on a moo point. And I thought that'd be a fun place to start the conversation. So, Eric, when we see these malaprops, part of it is just sort of the inherent way that human beings grow up hearing certain things, and it kind of bends it a certain way here. But why do we mangle language so often? Why, we've got quite a lot of acorns. I was going to say eggcorns in our language.
Well, English is a very mangleable language. It's a couple of us here have young kids and have realized sort of stepping out of the language a little bit and building it up from the baseline. it's confusing and it doesn't really make sense. And you just finish hammering out one point about why a certain vowel works a certain way, and then you turn the page and it just doesn't work the next time around. So I think the language lends itself to a fair amount of creativity of necessity. You have to try and navigate your way through it with a machete, and you don't always get it right. And sometimes they work.
Sometimes they really do. I've got a 2.5-year-old. Yours are older?
One older, one younger.
Okay, see, and my 2.5-year-old, the language is coming fast and furious now. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing to me. My wife and I will be sitting there, and he will come out with something, and I'll say, did you teach him that? And she'll say, no, did you teach him that? It came from somewhere. And most of the time he nails it, but it's even more beautiful when he mangles it, because it's cute. The question is, does it stick or not? Are we teaching them pretty? I guess the first teacher is at home, right?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, I guess that's probably right here. They don't bother great writers like you, Andrea and Kevin, right? I mean, that's just part of the do you look at your own malaprops once in a while and just laugh? I mean, for me, I look back at Next Door, and I don't remember when the time I figured out that it wasn't a Next Door. the word was Next Door. But I used to have to laugh at that, don't you?
I think what's most probably embarrassing as a writer now is when I don't even realize, and at my age, I'm writing something and an editor corrects something, and I think, oh my gosh, for my entire life I've thought that was this thing, and
yes.
Now a editor has redlined it, and oh dear, you know.
You're wondering, how many other times did I use it in this fashion? Yeah. And I would suspect, Kevin, I think we're probably around the same age, that if we go back to our childhood, there's a lot of Eggcorn/malaprops in music that we grew up listening to, singing words that were actually off that might make sense.
Yeah. I'll just say I don't have a child, but I have a 4-year-old blog, and I can look back and I can see tons of acorns.
They grow so fast, don't they?
The blogs, you mean, or the children? The blogs, yeah.
So they're everywhere. As a writer, it's not about, of course, being correct all the time. It's about correcting yourself when you're wrong. And trying to never make that mistake again. But it's fun when you catch it too.
I recall my mother listening to a Bare Naked Ladies song growing up called Grade 9, and the chorus said, "This is me in Grade 9, baby, yeah." And my mother sang it for years off the cassette tape that we recorded for her, and she would always walk around the house going, "This could be a great night, baby, yeah." And I thought, Mom, that's actually a pretty decent song. It's totally unrelated. So that was sort of a musical Eggcorn. And already we've got Brian on Twitter saying, do you guys follow Language Log online? They've first turned me on to many Eggcorns, but a good resource. Language Log, anybody? I've not heard of Language Log.
No.
Don't know.
And that's a good place to pivot the conversation on just how we become better writers, because I think Eggcorns are just sort of funny. But I think the process of becoming a great writer, and I don't know how you define what a great writer is, but the process of becoming a good writer is an interesting one, and there's no set paradigm for it. So Eric Grody, who writes about theater and film for the New York Times and teaches at Syracuse University, when did you realize that you could really write?
Oh, I mean, it's an ongoing process. I mean, you get good feedback along the way, certainly, or bad feedback. But I mean, you're always improving. I mean, it's never, you're never. I don't know if you're ever really. I mean, some writers are better than others. But I mean, it's something I drum in with my students all the time. They're here for 1 year. I teach in a 1-year graduate program at Syracuse, and they learn a lot while they're there. But the vast majority of what they learn will come after the fact. And the main way you do it is by reading a lot of a wide variety of other writers. You can realize you're a good writer through kind of glib, you write something that makes someone crack a smile or nod knowingly, and that's there's a lot of satisfaction from that. But I feel like the real satisfaction comes from just having an idea and looking down on the page and seeing that you've sustained it and executed it, and each paragraph amplifies what you had before that, and that the whole thing really holds together and makes sense in a holistic way. I think that's the goal you're really pushing for.
And that's a very professional sort of analysis of it. But was there a moment in second grade, ninth grade, fourth grade where you said, I love writing and I want to keep doing it?
I'm trying to think back. I mean, I enjoyed one thing that I realized pretty early on is I don't really have a creative bone in my body. Like I love dealing with the arts, and the program that I work with is involved with cultural writing, but I don't think of what I do. I know Kevin here is majoring in creative writing. I have such admiration for people who can do creative writing. I think of what I do as not terribly creative. To me, I come at it from a fairly mechanical way. And so I found as a kid that the stuff was that was being rewarded involved more of the flights of fancy and the stuff that I enjoyed reading. But even at that age, that wasn't really how my mind clicked in.
Yeah, interesting. Before we even get further into the conversation of that, let's welcome a first caller, because Rick from Brighton has a comment about Ed Korns. And if you want to share any of your favorite malaprops and Ed Korns, we have open phones this hour. Rick, go ahead.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I have one that I had as a child, and one question I'll ask as an aside is, after I give this, is how frequently the same ones keep coming up and how often you find unique ones. But the one I had as a small child that plagued me as a child, and for I'm embarrassed to say I was fairly old before I figured it out, was when I was a child, there was this mysterious letter of the alphabet that I could never understand where it came from, what it looked like, when it was used. And it was, I figured out in my head, decided it was some type of different form of the letter P, and I bothered me, and it was called elemental P. And where I got it from was, of course, the line A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, elemental P.
Elemental P.
Wonderful.
That is fabulous. And when did you realize that? You were in your 20s or 30s?
Well, I was probably about 12.
12. I'm with you. No, I would bet you're not alone there, Rick. That is a perfect example. Well, it's a perfect contribution there, because P is an elemental letter. I mean, it's right there. It's thank you, Rick. Thank you for starting the conversation from our listeners. If you want to join the conversation, it's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994, at Evan Dawson on Twitter, if you want to jump in there, as other people are already doing. All right. So, Kevin, when did you realize that you love to write? Because I think Eric makes an interesting point. Every writer sort of has a different background and a different bent. He doesn't consider himself creative. Mm-hmm. You are majoring in creative writing, but when was it in your background that you fell in love with that part of the craft?
Yeah, I remember very clearly. Fifth grade, I watched a lot of movies when I was a kid, and I just immediately knew I wanted to do that. I wanted to write. I wanted to tell stories. And so I'd go and I'd write these stories, which actually were very similar to the ones to the movies I were watching. But I would pass them out around school, and kids would love them. They'd look forward to them. Mostly scary stories. I don't know. I just love that. So I've been writing since I was very young. But something happened when I was in high school when I discovered music, and I started learning to play the guitar and playing in bands, and I realized writing songs were so much easier than writing stories. It could be done in 5 minutes, whereas as creative writing, after I got over the initial joy of just being able to write, I realized that really turning it into something magical takes a lot of work, and it takes a lot of revision and a lot of mechanics. And for a while, I just wasn't up to the task. And I just thought, hey, music's way easier. So I pushed writing aside, and then but just found my way back to it. Started writing blogs, started writing a lot of creative nonfiction. And then I just found these stories inside me again that just need to be told. So since I was a kid, took some time off, back at it. It's just something you can't get rid of if you have the bug.
When you were a child, were you writing longhand?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, did you keep anything?
I wish. No, I have no idea.
I have a couple of, you will never see them, but I have a 284-page, I will loosely call it a book, that was science fiction comedy written in the seventh grade with myself and a friend. Longhand, I would write two or three pages at a time, hand it to him between classes, he'd write two or three pages at a time. And I haven't read it in years, I don't know why we kept it, but I loved that process of writing longhand. And I can't write more than a couple paragraphs longhand now without my hand getting tired. Mm. But we used to do it all the time, didn't we?
Yeah, and I actually prefer it now. I try my biggest discipline is to get off the computer when I'm writing a first draft. It's so important. It's this connecting to the paper, but also disconnecting from the internet and from distractions. So if I can, that's where I start.
All right. Before I ask Andrea the same question, this is Patrick in Rochester, a former junior high English teacher. Go ahead, Patrick.
Hi, Evan. Thank you very much. Yeah, I've been listening. I love this because it's just where I live, and I'm a bit of a grammar geek, and I totally believe in the idea that the language changes, particularly with, you know, the advent of video and audio rather than written language, and to the concept of what you hear and how you hear it. Case in point, all the sudden drives me crazy. I hear people say that constantly, all the sudden. What happened to of? I don't understand that.
Yeah.
And another thing was where the junior high kids would be writing about their experiences, and they would say, I slept over a friend's house. And I would draw a little picture of a bed floating over their friend's house.
Well, some of them might have actually done that, but okay.
Yeah, well, it may be. I don't know. But my big thing is the transition because of audio versus written. We lose the beginning of the language, the real reason for the language. Case in point, the word probably, based on the word probable. Kids understand probable, but by the time they actually say it, they've gone to probably, and then prowly, which is also fun. But the final denigration of this thing is the word pry. Have you heard this one?
Pry?
I probably won't be over until tomorrow.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yep.
That's
all based on the fact that they hear it rather than they write it, and they read it, and they can understand its meaning by looking at it. They base all of their understanding on how it sounds. And I appreciated the fact that you would say, you mentioned that earlier in the thing about it's how you hear it and what you hear.
Yeah, well, great comments, Patrick. I appreciate that. And for me, along those lines, I don't know what the panel thinks, I'm worried that helping verbs are endangered. I think people will say, the car needs washed, you know, and it really needs to be washed, you know, or, you know, this needs fixed. And that's a little, whatever happened to helping verbs?
Well, that's a regionalism. I think that's...
Is that regionalism?
You hear that a lot in southern Pennsylvania. That's where I associate that
I
with.
Hear that the house needs here painted. More and more.
Well, and I'm wondering now, as I saw a study not that long ago, that you can actually see that people tweet regionally, that you'll see certain quirks of the language pop up, whether it's y'all from the south or perhaps what you just described with the house needs painted. That these disseminate, but as tweets get retweeted, I mean it's a perfect microcosm for how this stuff gets kind of disaggregated from its specific locality, and stuff just gets out into the air, and you still see and hear a lot of regionalisms, but that's the kind of thing that dissipates, I think, over time and just gets absorbed everywhere.
Yeah, very interesting. Andrea Lewandowski, again, a freelance writer for 585 Magazine. She writes deeperstory.com. She's the author of a soon-to-be-published memoir. She smiles every time I say it, but it's true. When did you really start writing, even as a kid, do you remember?
Oh, yeah. I have. I started writing when I was, as soon as I learned how to write, I have every journal and poetry book and story I've written since then. I don't know what that says about my compulsive hoarding, but I have them all. But I, as long as I can remember, I've loved writing. It's been, I think it was in high school and I realized that not everybody actually loves to write. It just seemed like such a natural thing for me in communication, writing letters. And I started writing for our school newspaper and creative writing, any avenue of writing, songwriting. It just brought me so much joy. And then when I realized people hated it, I just couldn't understand. Why would you hate writing?
Do you do any writing by hand anymore?
Yes, I do. I try to write some, when I write some fiction, I try to write it by hand. I find that it detaches me from the internet. I'm easily distracted by Twitter and Facebook.
Boy,
and the like.
Me too.
So if I can get offline completely to write that way, and I try to do handwritten letters to people, I feel like it's one of the only
ways. Not just thank you cards?
No, yeah, just like I'm thinking of you.
That's great. That is great.
I don't do it as often as I wish, but for the reason of connecting, getting something in the mail, or just using my hand and writing something.
All right, so you still write some by hand. Kevin, do you write any by hand anymore?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
That's... Eric?
Well, part of it is by job requirement. When I write about theater or film, if I'm in a theater, whether it's a movie theater or a stage theater, I'm scribbling in the dark. So there's a lot of writing stuff down that I then have to see if I can read what I wrote later on. But I'm left-handed, and so I get a lot of smear, whether it's graphite in the old days as a school kid mm-hmm. or even ink. My hand goes over what I just wrote, and so I do some writing. But it gets messy for both reasons I just said.
I've never considered the disadvantage left-handers face. And I have a twin brother who's left-handed. And I was the one who ended up loving to write, by hand.
Back in the number two pencil day, it really had consequences.
We had an author on this program a few months back named Sean Goodman, who is an Ithaca school psychologist who's also written some award-winning young adult fiction. And he writes by hand exclusively. And because he says, first of all, he loves to do it. Second of all, he says he has read, and I would assume he's right, that when you write by hand, it activates the creative part of your brain, and when you type, mm-hmm. it activates the more technical side. You're nodding.
I've heard that, yeah.
Makes sense to you?
Yes.
I would say, too, my experience with handwriting is there's just this freedom that happens where you can underline words, you can write in the margin, it kind of becomes this piece of art that you're working on, and it doesn't, and nothing matters. But when you're typing on a computer, it looks like it's already in final draft form, even if it's obviously not, it's in first draft. But when you're on a piece of paper, you can do whatever you want. You can cross out whole paragraphs and just scribble out words, write in new ones, and that's part of the fun, and I think that's where the creativity really launches.
When it comes to editing, what is the value of a tough editor? I'll start with Eric. Do you have a tough regular editor?
Yes, several.
Vicious? I mean, you write for the New York Times, I imagine.
Some tougher than others, but I mean, people they definitely want things to read a certain way, and they're not gonna say it's okay until they feel it's okay, which is enormously helpful, and it's something I try to do. As a professor is it takes work to get the stuff up there. I mean, I find it very hard to teach insight. A lot of what we're currently working with my students are reviews. They've seen films or listened to music and they're writing reviews now. And the easiest ones to teach are the ones who have interesting ideas or insights into it. And it's literally just, how do I turn that into a series of sentences on the page? I love working with that because that is a very learnable and very teachable skill. There are tricks to it and there are gambits you can learn, but I mean, a lot of it is just practice and exposing yourself to a lot of other writing. But it, for very, very few people, I would say almost nobody does that come instinctively. It takes work and it takes editing.
There are going to be students who don't want to be edited, and I'm sure there are journalists and writers and creative writers mm-hmm. who don't want to be edited. What do you say to the student who is hesitant to have their work torn up a bit?
We talk a lot about this whole idea of your voice, and I think some students come in hesitant that they're afraid they're going to get square pegged into writing in a certain style that's not their own mm-hmm. voice. And I'm conscious of that. To me, good writing doesn't look the same. Good writing is just a slightly better version of the way that person talks, or in some cases a more than slightly better version of the way that person talks, but an idealized way, you know, this sort of thing. If you look back and you wished you could have said it a little more succinctly or a little more deftly or artfully, that's what good writing would look like.
And you make a point about maintaining a voice, that a good editing job can be tough, thorough, trim some of the fat while maintaining an author's voice. Eric, I don't think, gives himself enough credit. When you write reviews, you still have a voice. I mean, think of Pete Wells writing reviews for the New York Times. Does mm-hmm. Pete Wells have a voice?
My absolutely,
goodness
yes.
gracious, does he have a voice? I mean, and your work absolutely has a voice. I mean, don't you feel, even though you claim not to be all that creative, don't you feel that your work has a voice?
No, it does. It does have a voice. Yes, I mean, I think that's fair. When I say creative, I'm referring more to actually generating entire
from whole cloth.
Yes,
absolutely. But that doesn't mean that your work doesn't have a voice.
Fair enough.
And that's why I asked the question, because you're both a writer and a professor. And I think I remember my own early days in writing. I was so worried that someone was going to destroy it, that I was going to be left. You know, that it was going to be a shell of it, or it was going to be some sort of a condemnation of me as opposed to making it better.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, the point that we really try to hammer home with the students is that all we're trying to make them sound like is just an even better version of themselves. It really isn't trying to do this Procrustean mashing them into something they're not. It's just bringing out the best version of what they have in them already.
Andrea, Kevin, you ever worry about losing your voice to an editor?
Oh, yeah. I think that you put a lot of your personal pride into a piece and the fear that someone's going to rip it apart. But more often than not, it turns out fine in my experience. And I think a good editor really helps you become a better writer. And writers tend to be cynics anyway, so we're afraid that everyone's going to steal our our souls, basically.
Yeah, and I think a matured writer will really value a good editor.
Yeah.
As I've progressed in my writing, that's what I look forward to the most, is having it picked apart and having an editor return it back to me so I can improve it. I wrote a play earlier this year, and without the workshops that went into it, it wouldn't have been half of what it turned out to be. And I think a good editor is invaluable. It's.
And yet, the play still retains the voice and sort of the overall frame that you created for it. You just feel it's better, it's stronger.
Yeah, and if something's removed, it's just clutter, usually.
Yeah.
You know, it's not your voice.
See, in second grade, I remember I was in a writing contest, and my mother helped me so much that she practically wrote the story that got turned in, and I felt like I was borderline embarrassed about it, but I think she was just trying to be a helpful mother. But she was also, she and my dad both were great editors and have been throughout the years. Let's take a quick call before we get to, wow, all of a sudden the phones are on fire here. Gretchen in Canandaigua, go ahead, Gretchen.
Hi, I wanted to ask about the correctness of something that I have seen written in many different newspapers. When people say she will graduate high school instead of graduate from high school, or he graduates college in the fall, in the spring, that's not correct, is it?
I suspect you're correct, but there's only one professor in the room. you're the adjudicator here.
I was going to ask for a show of hands here. To me, that sounds wrong.
Yeah, I don't think you graduate high school. I think you graduate from high school.
It's from. There's something. There's something between graduate and high school, correct? Or college or whatever.
It sounds like that's correct.
And seeing the nods around here, that seems kind of unanimous over here.
Well, why is it's constantly it's spoken on TV and in plays and in books and in newspapers, including the New York Times, by the way. Weird.
That is duly noted, Gretchen. And Eric, you're going to take that back to your colleague?
As soon as we're done here.
If the New York Times is doing it, it's got to make sense.
This is Chuck in Pittsburgh. Go ahead, Chuck.
Actually, I called and saying I had a pet peeve, and it was the graduate high school. I'm quite sure it's graduate from high school, and no matter whether the New York Times agrees with me or not, I'll stay with what I was doing. Two other things. I don't know if anybody on the panel is old enough to remember sentence diagramming.
Sure. Oh, absolutely.
Sure. Definitely.
And I was one of the few who loved it in my class.
Yeah, I think that's last part. The last thing is about handwriting. You might find that using a fountain pen rather than a ballpoint pen, or if that's too messy, a fiber tip pen might make handwriting less exhausting because you don't have to put the pressure on the paper. And for the left-handed theater reviewer, some years ago I did a workbook on penmanship, and they recommended that left people turn the paper to the side so that they're writing down the page rather than across the page.
Oh.
And that might be something to think about.
It's a good idea. Thank you.
Good stuff, Chuck. I appreciate that. We had a comment on Twitter from Sarah, who said that essentially said that we have lost some of the romanticism of creating writing because we don't teach cursive anymore. And I wasn't even really going to go here, and then I see that comment, and I thought, oh man, people really are fired up about teaching cursive anymore. And as soon as our engineer, poor Mike Black, our engineer today, is all over the phone calls, which is great. We have people are fired up about language, which is exciting to me. But I wanted to play a brief comment to kick off a little discussion on cursive. Author John Green, the author of The Fault in Our Stars, had a few comments recently. He does a lot of video blogging as well with his brother Hank. This is author John Green talking about whether we need to teach cursive.
At no point in my life has it been even inconvenient to me then I cannot write in cursive. Now, I did learn to write cursive, but I forgot because things that aren't useful or interesting, you forget. and cursive is not useful. It's just not useful. It's just not important.
That's John Green. And Andrea, you're shaking your head. What do you think?
Well, I teach classes on handwriting and hand lettering, so I've taught people how to write in cursive as adults. And I've heard that schools are stopping teaching cursive. I was tutoring a girl this summer, and she asked me, how do you write that way? And she was 13. I thought, my goodness, what do you mean, how do I write this way? This is cursive. I think, was that Sarah who tweeted in, I think the art of writing is a beautiful lost art. If you look 100 years ago, letters, I mean, things were beautiful pieces. Writing just had it was a whole process. I think, and technology in some ways has stolen that from us, the joy of making something beautiful, not just in word, but even in just appearance. So I'm a big advocate for cursive. I'm teaching my six-year-old now how to write in it. I just think you take your time. If you want to write someone a letter, I want to take my time when I write it. I want it to look well. I want that to be something they treasure.
And you write in cursive when you write letters?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Wow.
I it's my natural. It's what I do first is cursive. So so I'm a big advocate.
Professor Grody, does cursive matter to you?
Look, whatever makes writing, the process of writing, pleasurable for those around me. I'm someone who penmanship, as I think it was called then, managed to keep me off of a couple honor rolls. Back, I had fairly abysmal
handwriting.
You're
still carrying a chip on your shoulder for that.
Well, I mean, I think if you were to look back at the ones that I write in the pitch black theater and the stuff I would write in broad daylight, I'm not sure you could see the difference that probably that much in terms of handwriting. But hey, whatever works.
Oh, we're very late for a break, and we're going to spend the rest of the program. Well, we'll take more of your calls, and we're going to talk about how to improve and whether we do really improve as writers, which is an interesting idea, but we're going to have some comments from one of my favorite writers coming up. We've got a great panel today. Our thanks to Eric Grody, who writes about theater and film regularly for the New York Times and teaches in the Gold Ring Arts Journalism Program at Syracuse University. Andrea Lewandowski, a freelance writer for 585 Magazine, deeperstory.com. And the author of a soon-to-be-published memoir, Kevin Carr, who is studying creative writing at the University of Rochester, writes thenumberkevin.com, writes for various publications, and has covered the fringe like no one else here. All of these panelists taking your calls and talking writing as we continue on member-supported public radio. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. And before we get to the phones, and I should say, if you're on the phone waiting, and there are a lot of you, we will get to you. I wanted to turn the conversation toward how to improve as a writer with our excellent panel today. And one of my favorites, in fact, I think the best writer of the generation I've grown up with was David Rakoff, who passed away 2 years ago at the age of 47 from cancer. He wrote essays in a number of publications. You might have heard him on This American Life. And he sat down to talk about, before he died, he sat down to talk about how to improve as a writer. And he actually said he doesn't think that he does, but here were his thoughts on why he writes and how to improve.
I do it because I love being listened to the extent that being a writer means that you get listened to. You know, it's the job for bullies. It's you think that what you have to say is so unearthly important that people should listen to you. I do it because I think there's nothing more, truly nothing more powerful than words, than the capacity to convince through verbiage. I mean, it's an unbelievable power. So I do it for that reason. But it is never easy, and it gets harder. Writing only ever begins badly. And you have to sit and tolerate yourself. And unlike cooking, where you basically put together a meal out of palatable ingredients, what you have to essentially do is reverse engineer something edible from rotten, stinking, slimy, moldy food. That can be hard. And it's also so counter to the trajectory of every other human task because as I've gotten older, I've gotten better at everything else. We all do. I have not gotten better at writing. It's as if like you were going to sit down to make eggs and every single time is like, this has the capacity to just, the eggs have the capacity to like burst into flame and burn the house down. You're like, how can this be every single time? And every single time it's like that.
That's David Rakoff, who is being too hard on himself. I mean, I don't know how to describe him as a writer other than I thought he was brilliant. And I did think he improved, but those were his takes. Kevin, what do you think when you hear his take on improving or lack of improvement?
He's being hard on himself for sure. I've read his stuff and he was amazing. I think improving as a writer starts with just writing all the time and reading all the time. But even before that, I think something that people skip over is just master of grammar. You have to master grammar. It's a must. And as I improve, I find that I become more and more confident in punctuation. It's something as simple as that. And not to bring the conversation back around, but I think cursive can be important, but our kids are graduating high school without knowing what a semicolon does. And that's, I believe, something that should be hammered in as early as cursive is.
Yeah, I think that's well said. Professor Grody, thoughts on what David Rakoff was saying?
Well, I quite like, I mean, I like David's work and always did. Something stuck out to me hearing it this time was the idea of good writing being convincing. One thing that I've been working with my students, this was a new project that we took on this year. It was one of the first things I did with my students this year. And again, these are grad students, so they've been exposed to a fair amount of writing already. I asked them to find a review. It could be of anything. It could have run in any venue. The only two things I asked them to do is I said it had to be, in their opinion, a very well-written, compelling, convincing review. And it had to have the exact opposite stance on this movie or this album or this opera or whatever than they themselves had. They had to completely disagree with what they were seeing, but had to concede that it was a well-written piece. This was much more difficult for some than I thought it would be. One of the students actually had to call her mom. She got herself so upset reading these reviews that just got it so wrong. And it made me realize, which was what fueled this assignment in part in the first place, the internet allows people to be surrounded by like-minded people all the time. You can set up your Facebook page, your websites, that you never really find people who feel other than how you feel about something. And that's very destructive, in my opinion. I really think there's a lot of value in being reminded that your take on the world doesn't have a monopoly on insight. And
thank you for saying that to a host who next hour is going to be talking to the founder of Live Action, which is a pro-life group. That part of our audience may agree with and part of our audience may not, but I appreciate the sentiment there.
and there, I think, to be able to divorce that from, to be able to just look at the work on its merits, there's a lot of value in that. And that's something that we've worked on. And that's something that I feel like David touched on briefly there.
But I think that your students are getting better as writers. And I think David was being a little hard on himself with the notion that he never got better. I can't believe that.
Yeah,
I think he's maybe referring to just the pain of starting. I don't think that ever gets easier.
That may be right.
It's always hard. I've said this before. I hate writing. I really enjoy having written. I do like being able to look down at something and say, like, hey, that didn't exist until it came into my head, and then I eventually got it on the page through a lot of iterations, and by hook and crook, it got there. But the process is very difficult.
He used a turn of phrase to describe it that I could not play as well, but he agrees that it is like extracting teeth at times. So anyway, and Andrea, do you think you get better as a writer? What's your approach to improving?
To some degree, I think that if you think that your work isn't getting better, that might make you a better writer. I think that the most super confident writers might not have the best view of their pieces. The more critical I can be of myself, the more I can improve a piece and hopefully get it out in a better version than if I just thought, well, this is perfect as it is and no one should touch it and it's great writing and if you touch it, you know, so maybe that's part of it as well. So I hope that I'm becoming a better writer, but I think I'm getting more critical of my own work as I get older.
I hope I'm becoming wiser. I remember it wasn't that long ago when I don't remember where it came from, but I learned the lesson of stop being so addicted to modifiers, because if you're overusing modifiers, you're missing great opportunity for language. So I've tried to essentially excise very from my writing, because I used it very much, and it was a crutch. And I'm not just talking about words that can't be modified, like unique. You know, I mean, I'm talking about just overusing modifiers. But that was not something that I was even cognizant of until recently. I don't consider myself an excellent writer by any means, but the Evan from 5 years ago probably was overusing modifiers. So, David Rakoff, if you're listening anywhere, I think your work stands to reason that we do improve. We just may not feel it all the time. That's what I would say. Let me get back to the phones, and then I'll ask our panel what their reading habits are, because that's always fascinating when you hear we're all so busy, some of us raising kids, some of us raising blogs, some of us raising books. What are our reading habits? But let me get back to the phones here, as the computer just died. No, there we are. This is Dan in Brighton. Go ahead, Dan. Dan, are you there?
I am here, and I have two questions unrelated. First one is, if people don't know cursive, how are they going to sign their names? And the second one is, I've been listening a lot to people say, I'm going to try and, as in try and go to the store, and try and see a movie, instead of try to. When did this happen? And I'm going to hang up and listen.
I don't know, but he's definitely right about that one.
Yeah.
It's try to, not try and. When it comes to cursive and signing names, confession time. I did not know until recently that we were supposed to sign in cursive, and I have never once signed my name on a signature in cursive. My signature is not cursive.
Is it an X?
It is not an X. And, but I don't know if it's legally valid. So I've been signing these for years. So my answer to Dan from Brighton with that is, that's a fair point on signing, but we probably as a society could function if we just decided cursive wasn't required anymore for those of us scofflaws like myself who have been doing it that way for years. But I love hearing these points, man. I love the edge on some of the frustration people have with language. This is Abe in Brighton. Go ahead, Abe.
Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I'm fascinated to hear a discussion about words, and I don't recall hearing any reference yet either to the dictionary or the all-important Rogers Thesaurus. The reason I bring this up is that every time I look in the dictionary, I see a great number, multiple definitions of each word, and so many words could be used in different parts of speech, a noun, a verb, etc. And for any aspiring writer or thinker, the exact definition of words is really important. In fact, I'm fascinated sometimes when I look up simple words that I think I understand, only to find so many meanings that I had not been thinking of.
I think that's well said. Let me ask our professor to sort of continue on the theme that when he said words have meanings that matter. I remember a couple of weeks ago, a friend of mine said something that really aggravated him, and I said, "You mean agitated?" He said, "Aggravated." I said, "Aggravate means to make worse. Agitate means to agitate." And he said, boy, I never knew that. So I looked it up, and now it's sort of colloquially accepted that if you use aggravate, well, it's understood to mean to annoy. But that wasn't really the initial creation of the word. And should we care about that, Professor? Is it okay that language sort of shifts with usage?
It's more than just okay. It's essential that it shifts with usage. I mean, you'll have a dead language if you have a language that doesn't accommodate the times, within reason. I mean, we all have our own pet peeves. I have a thing with nouns that become verbs or vice versa, you know, and the whole transitioning and
you'd
trending
like to remedy
and that,
that
sort of thing. I don't love them, but I
you
find
see what
myself
I just did there?
Yes, I did. I chose almost to not see it.
Yeah.
I heard someone not that long ago say, as the numbers continue to attrit, that's something we'll have to look at, like attrition as a verb.
Oh.
That's a bridge too far for me. I've just about given up with transitioning, but there's always. I mean, I think it's good to push back a little bit and to shrug and let some of them come through the door.
Let's ask the other writers. Language and words have meaning. Are we? What do you think when we see?
Go ahead.
Abe.
Thank you. I do have one example that I'd like to share. I think we've all heard that expression. If a tree falls in the forest and there's no one there, does it make a sound? And if you look up the word sound in the dictionary, you'll see about a dozen different definitions, including the Long Island sound or to sound the alarm. But one definition of sound is the compression, the air compression creating waves, and another definition of sound is the human interpretation of those waves. So, of course, if a tree falls in the forest and there's no one there, the air will compress. But if there's no human there, then there can't be human perception of those waves. So if we're to use words scientifically and we're trying to be precise with our meaning, then we have to know what the words mean.
I think that's fair enough, and maybe we should the phrase should be, does it make a noise instead of sound? Maybe that's what it should be. But I think that's well taken. Andrea and Kevin?
I think with Twitter and Facebook these days, I feel like everyone's trying to shorten what words they're using, and they're trying to say as much as they can in a shorter amount of space. So people are interchanging words that they might think apply and might not necessarily apply, but it kind of covers the what they're trying to get through in 140 characters or less. So I see people shortening words, changing their meaning just for the sake of getting a point across, and if that happens enough, the word has a new definition.
Yeah.
What do you think, Kevin?
I think the caller mentioned dictionaries, and that's such an important tool for the writer to look at every word they use and see if it makes sense in the way they're using it. And I don't always do that like I should. And but I do feel that's one thing that as a writer improves, he or she is more conscious of what are the words I'm using, not just this is a phrase that I hear a lot, so I'm going to use it in this sentence. Does the phrase even make sense? Does it make sense in this narrative structure? Looking at every word and using the dictionary like a tool, I think it's very important.
And Evan, you mentioned before trying to get your clear up your own writing, get some of the verbiage out, the modifiers and that sort of thing. The pieces I write a lot of time tend to be on the short side, and the word counts that I give my students tend to be on the short side. And there's that Pascal quote where it was, I'm sorry this letter is so long, I didn't have time to write a shorter one. Like it really does take work to press the coal down to get to the diamond. But as you're saying with modifiers, I mean, you know, if you find the right verb, those are probably three adjectives you don't need. Or if you find the right adjective, you can trim a lot of that out of the way. That's something that does take, it's not people's nature. We do write, if we text or whatever, we write fast. Mm-hmm. And it's very helpful to stop and slow down and how could that be a little better?
And I try to use the words that actually mean what the root says. I don't like to say amazing unless it actually mm-hmm. amazes. I don't mm-hmm. like to say incredible unless it actually strains credibility. I don't like to say terrific unless there might be actually something borderline terrifying about it. That's why a crutch of mine is remarkable, but remarkable for me is better than amazing, terrific, or incredible for those reasons. So we're going to try to get through a couple more calls. Real briefly, I want to ask our panel what your reading routine is. Professor, you write for the New York Times, you teach at Syracuse, you've got kids at home. What are you reading?
I juggle. I juggle more than I probably should. I have a couple books going. And with the family and stuff now, I don't have as much time to read as I used to, and so occasionally I'll pick up and forget I have to go back. But I, you know, I'm a creature of the digital age. I have a lot of tabs open with a lot of things that I'm mm-hmm. reading. I try not to skim. I try to anything. I decide I'm either going to read this or I'm not going to read this.
Yeah.
And if something is worth my time, I'm going to give it my time. And if it's not, I'm just going to click on and not try. But I do try to do right by everything I read.
Andrea?
Yeah, I have a stack of books. I go through a steady diet of poetry, classics, and some modern works from fellow writers who I'm reading, the friends of mine who write stuff. So it changes, but I like to keep it changing all the time. Otherwise, I get bored or I need it to change. So that's why I have a big stack.
I make book lists. I have to. That way my brain goes, you have to get through this list. You have to check it off. And it works. Over summer, I made a 10 book list. And it was amazing. I just felt like I had to get through it. And that way you just get in this rhythm where you're always reading.
Mm-hmm. I like to remind myself of all the great writing I won't have time to read, so I subscribe to The New Yorker. Jan from Rochester. Go ahead, Jan.
Are you calling Jan?
Jan, go ahead.
Okay, two things. When I was working a long time ago here in the county, I wrote a column for the DNC and included a sentence that had a preposition at the end. My fellow worker said to me, you can't do that, if they won't take it. I said, that's the only way I get the emphasis where I want it. And what pleased me terrifically is that I still have a copy of that article, and the preposition sentence was in the headline on the editorial page.
It was a stylistic choice, though. And, Jan, I've got 20 seconds. Go to the next one. Go ahead.
Okay, the other thing is the English leave the prepositions out. They graduate high school. They leave the hospital. They don't put the prepositions in. You just have to watch the English little series on TV, and you learn that.
Jan, great answer for a question that was left hanging there for us, even though I think we've alighted upon the best use, which is still to graduate from something. But interesting that the English do it that way. And look at this. Phone's lighting up as we have to end the program, which just means to our panel. Will you come back and continue this conversation on a different day?
Sure, happy to.
I mean, Eric Grody has nothing to do with most of his time. He writes about theater and film regularly for the New York Times. He teaches journalism at Syracuse University. He's got kids at home, but, you know.
Why not?
Thank you. Thank you for your expertise. It's been great having you here. Andrea Levandusky, you can find her at 585 Magazine, deeperstory.com, soon to be a book. Thank you for being
here.
Thank
you for having me.
Kevin Carr, find him at thenumberkevin.com, among other things, 585 Magazine and more. Kevin, thank you.
Thank you for having me. Come say hi to me on Twitter.
You got it. Great stuff, everybody. Short break and right back on member-supported public radio.